Okay, so I actually want to address three issues here. And so I made a deal with the chairman to do the first two. Oops, where's the light? To do the first two. And the reason is that we have some very interesting, well, I'm excited about some very recent work that I want to talk to you about, and I want to make sure I have enough time to do that. And so first I want to address this issue of the strange metal phase. And you know, there's this discussion of whether this is can be understood as a quantum critical point or just some kind of crossover behavior. And I just want to explain our view that this strange metal can be thought of as some kind of spin charge separated state which cross over to zero gap and Fermi liquid. This is an old story, and I hope to go get through it rather quickly. But I do want to mention that the traditional view is that this quantum critical region in the renormalization group sense is that when you have some unstable fixed point, and basically if you flow very close to this unstable fixed point, then the physics is dominated by this quantum critical point. And within this view, actually, the interesting action is not somewhere here, but the issue is what? How do you describe the pseudo gap? And I want to claim that our view is rather that the pseudo gap is the one that is controlled by some unstable fixed point. But this unstable fixed point is not a quantum critical point. I mean, you can generalize this idea that if the flow is if this physical property is dominated by the proximity to some any kind of unstable phase, then you have this. And the candidate of this phase, we have a rather explicit candidate for this, is something we may call a nodal spin liquid. And I want to explain to you a little bit about that. And also, we have some experimental proposal with my friend Santo to try to nail down this kind of a behavior. And then the next question, and I'm very thankful to Brett Marston because he gave a splendid introduction to what I want to talk about here, is the question of whether, so as you see, the spin liquid idea plays a very central role to my thinking and all this RVB thinking. And the holy grail really has been, does spin liquid actually exist in nature? Right. So the question is, has anyone ever seen this experimentally? And I think the answer is quite possibly yes, that this organic material that Brett mentioned, I think seems to be a very promising candidate that we indeed maybe have a first example of a spin liquid insulator. And then if we believe that that's the case, then the question is, what kind of spin liquid is it? Who is this guy, right? And because the spin liquid actually lives not deep in the insulator, but right at the proximity to the metal insulator, you need to address this, you need to talk about a Hubbert model rather than just a TJ model, which is what we've been working on. And so this very recent work with a postdoc, Seung-Sik Lee at MIT, we claim that the Hubbert model also can be transformed into a U1 gauge theory. And I'll show you that very quickly. And that, and then we study the possibility of forming spin on Fermi surface in a triangular lattice, and also the possibility of finding a nodal spin liquid of this type in a honeycomb lattice. Okay, so for the first point, you're keeping time for me, right? The high TC superconducting problem, we think, has to do, the starting point is a TJ model. And just very early on, there mean field theory based on some decoupling on fermions and bosons to enforce a constraint. And in fact, this mean field theory enjoyed some early success in the phase diagram. They predicted a D-wave superconductor as a ground state and also the spin gap phase by this model. There is a problem that this theory prefers HC over E vortex. Now, that problem was fixed by introduction of some SU2 formulation with Wen and myself. But the phase diagram doesn't change very much. And so the basic story is that indeed, at the mean field level, you have some kind of DOA superconductor, strange metal here. And if you go beyond mean field, then clearly these guys are not real transition, but they're crossover lines. And so we have a general picture that that this is a what we call a strange metal phase, which cross over to a spin gap phase here and a Fermi liquid here. And this is some data from Kaminsky et al. And you know, that's not that much data to go around, but roughly speaking, it's correspond quite well to this kind of idea. Just to say a few words about a strange metal phase, this is something that we worked on 10 years ago, and frankly, we have not made any progress on this problem in 10 years, so I cannot tell you too much about it, but let me just tell you what we knew, because some of this is actually relevant to the last part of my talk. So the idea is that we have fermion and boson coupled to some U1 gauge field. We may have a spin, that we want to interpret this region as a deconfined region where there's spin charge separation, but then as you go to lower temperature, it's unstable to confinement, and then we have recombination, and then we have a back to normal states. Now, in this theory, there is a singular transverse gauge propagator, which very unusual properties, and this gives rise, and then we have fermions and bosons coupled to the same gauge field, and the result is that the fermionic part can be treated quite well, because fermions are protected by a Fermi surface, so we knew quite a bit about this. Let me highlight a couple of important results. One is the specific heat has this peculiar T to the 2/3 behavior. And the second is that the conductivity due to the fermion goes as T to the 4/3. That there's a scattering rate. Transport time is actually T to the 4/3. I'm sorry? yeah, I think resistivity. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Yes, there should be a minus sign here. Thank you. So this theory turns out to be quite useful for fractional quantum Hall effect, and as you see, it may have some relevance to the spin liquid that I'll talk about later. Now, the tough part of this problem has to do with the boson, because the problem of bosons coupled with the gauge field is a very difficult problem, because there's no Fermi surface to protect you, Fermi statistic to protect you. However, for high temperature, then we indeed find that the resistivity is linear in temperature. And it turns out that the physical resistivity, there's a theorem by Yoffe and Larkin that you should add the resistivity, not the conductivity. So the physical conductivity is actually dominated by the boson. However, this is a very high temperature scale. It's not clear why this should continue to hold at low temperature. We make some attempt at improving that by doing some quantum Monte Carlo based on quasi-static gauge fields, and it seems that T persists, but that's all I can say about it. Okay, so that's it. Nothing much is known. So now the issue, the second question is, can I say something about a pseudo gap? And so this is a rather general picture that one might have, in that this is a doping diagram, and this is some kind of a generalized coupling. And one may imagine that you can imagine this is increasing amount of quantum fluctuation. That the quantum fluctuation can disorder the antiferromagnet. And here, one assume that there's a region where the spin liquid may exist. Now, so the question is, how do you approach the superconductivity problem? One direct approach is to say that the physical system may be going from antiferromagnet through some very incommensurate phases, very complicated regime, and end up with a superconductor. And it's very hard for us to go via the physical route to understand how do we end up with superconductor. So instead, the proposal is to take a shortcut that if we start here, we can go here, right? So that's the basis of the idea that we start with some spin liquid phase, and then by doping we end up with a superconducting phase. And so within this context, then it's very natural that there's a region in the phase diagram that where the physics is dominated by this spin liquid phase, and our explicit proposal is that there's a particular spin liquid which we call this nodal spin liquid, which possibly shows this signature of confinement. Now, there is actually a lot of progress that's been made in the last few years on understanding spin liquid and gauge theory. And this gauge theory and fermions are emergent properties, because when we start with spin models, which has nothing to do with fermions and gauge field, and this gauge field and fermions emerge as a low energy excitation spontaneously. And this has now been shown explicitly by a number of explicitly exactly soluble models, first by Kitaev and Wen and Motronich and Sentil, which explicitly show this mostly in the context of Z2 gauge theory. Now, In our case, we have a different spin liquid in mind, and this is one where we start out with a direct spectrum, which is, this is why we call it nodal, because the excitation is exactly the same as the nodal region of the D-wave superconductor. It has this direct cone, and it's coupled to some gauge field. Now, for a long time, people were thinking that this problem is always confining. However, a very recent work by last year by Mike Hermele here and many co-authors showed that this is in fact possible. And Brent mentioned this work, and also the work by Assad that suggests that n equal to 4 is in fact a deconfined state. And so I think there's a good possibility that such a deconfined state exists. And okay, let me. However, I should caution that deconfinement doesn't mean free fermions, as Matthew was saying. Okay. Yeah. So the question is, can we look for signature of this deconfinement if indeed it's true that this pseudo gap phase is dominated by this deconfined state? Well, then the question is how. Well, the signature of deconfinement is that there's some gauge flux which is actually conserved. And the question is how they detect it. And Santo and I made a proposal. Actually, Santo made a proposal. The idea is based on the fact that the reason why we get HD over two E vortex is that the vortex actually traps half of a flux of this mysterious gauge flux. And so we use this idea to produce and then detect the gauge flux. So the experiment is this. We make two rings with the outer ring has a higher TC than the inner ring, and the brown region would be the region of pseudo gap. Okay, so it's a challenge to my experimentalist friends to make such a device. It should be thin film. So the experiment is you first cool below the T1 in the presence of a small magnetic field. So that would trap a flux in general, right, and give rise to current running around. And so the idea is that if you trap a flux, physical flux, that will also trap a gauge flux in this brown region. Okay. Now, if this ring is very thin, then the physical magnetic field will escape, and you just get a circulating current. Now, you cool below the second ring, make a superconducting. So the thing has a choice. It can either, so this thing has, the inner ring would either expel the gauge flux completely, or it has, so all this gauge flux, which is delocalized, would have to go either enter the ring or go in between the ring. It has no choice. Right? And if it enters the ring, then it will spontaneously also generate a physical HC over E flux. And you can arrange it so that if this area is bigger than the outside area, that's energetically favorable for the flux to spontaneously generate. So the idea is that if you do this, if you cool below TC2, then you actually will spontaneously generate a flux in the inner ring. Okay. Now, the sign of this flux is actually arbitrary. It's not connected to the initial flux. So that can tell you that this is not just something driven by the original flux. And furthermore, this is a completely equilibrium problem because as long as the time scale to make this current to go around to form this flux is long compared with the microscopic time, this effect will happen.
Yeah.
Oh, because this is where the gauge flux will be supported. Remember, I'm trying to detect some property of the pseudo gap. Yeah, but I have to be able to communicate, because when I first make this one, it probably will be sufficient. But this, I think, it's better to do this. Yeah. Okay. So this is my first. Am I on time for the first part? Okay, yeah, all right. So I'll just take questions for a few minutes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess the thing that bothers me the most is that you have to use a spin liquid at half filling.
Yeah.
What's the rate of a half filling? Like that's the people in quantum or strange metal phase, like finite doping and high
temperature. Okay, yeah, strange metal phase is much far away, right?
Yes.
The half filling, that's something I thought I borrowed from you, because you were always bringing. It's very strange that you asked me that question, because that.
Well, be what I said.
Yeah. Okay. So this part of the talk really deals not with the strange metal phase, but the very underdoped pseudo gap region. So the idea is that the very underdog region, it's near this flow. I'm not saying that the strange matter is described by this. The strange matter is described by a completely different liquid. It's the full Fermi surface, the different spin liquid.
Okay. All right. I guess another thing in the theory is that, I guess at the end you say the vortices have a double degenerate. In ACM,
Oh, because the internal gauge flux can be up or down?
Yeah,
that actually corresponds to the orbital currents being, I have two degenerate way of making orbital current.
Okay. So this is an issue that, the underlying up and away from oscillating.
Yes.
And then certainly the tendency of the vortices is very robust, has nothing to do with gauge flux. It comes from symmetry arguments.
I guess I'm not sure I understand.
I would question the connection between your picture of the high temperature region and your conclusion about the low temperature vortices. I think the structure of the vortices is much more complicated than the vortices.
When I mentioned vortices, that's just to motivate this Pesento experiment.
Yeah.
Right. So the idea is simply that when I have a big ring and when I make a vortex on the outside, then this is a way of producing a flux on the inside. That's all I want for that part. Right. That's just to motivate the statement that if the pseudo gap indeed is in this deconfined phase with a conserved flux, then when I make the outer ring superconducting, they will generate a gauge flux on the inside. So we're just using that as a flux generator, right? Okay. So you can, since for experts, you can forget about what I said about vortices. That's not essential for this.
Right? Okay. So you have three different kinds of materials to make your experiment.
Yeah, different doping level. Right, you can have three different doping levels.
I think I may have missed it, but what advantages does this new Sentel experiment offer over the earlier Sentel Fisher experiment?
The earlier one is designed to detect the Z2 gauge theory, and the whole advantage of this U1 gauge theory is that this flux can expand. It's not localized to a plaquette. Right, so now this flux can expand to fill up this inner ring. So that's the main difference.
Under what conditions do materials know that they have to obey Z2 gauge theory or U1 gauge theory or SC2 gauge theory?
Oh, this fundamental Hamiltonian would tell you which one is stabilized. Yeah, and in our theory, the Z2 is never stabilized.
You're always been working on the same model, right? And your results have been, your gauge theories have been.
No, I don't think so.
Exactly?
No, I've been consistent. I mean, Matthew and Santo are the one who's been pushing the Z2. I've never said Z2.
No, but there has been a confusion,
right. Yeah.
About
yeah.
Formulation. And
yeah. Phase. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that should.
I think.
Yeah.
Some of us more recently. I mean, you have been using an SV2 formulation.
That's right.
Whatever you want.
That's right. I mean, what the phase, the state that comes is emergent. Everything is emergent,
yeah.
And you can get at this phase by many different means. So the physics decides it, and, we don't decide. I guess I'm not quite sure what your question is.
Physics. Have you calculated any property of the pseudo gap phase which is measured in one of the few thousand experiments?
Well, as I said, it's even predicted. I mean, the gap itself, the fact that there's a spin gap.
Have you compared your result? You wrote this 80-page review paper.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of experiments on it in the beginning and a lot of theory at the end. But nowhere did I find anywhere a theoretical curve with an experimental curve.
Well, I think the theory has not reached that stage. I'm the first to admit. I mean, I told you, this is a state in the theory. There are certain things you can compute, you calculate. For example, you can make very quantitative calculations of all the properties of the nodal quasi-particles in the superconducting state, and that's been a success story. Those things you can calculate. There are certain things that are difficult to calculate within the technology that we have, but what we can do is to identify the phases and try to identify crucial experiments to try to test them. And this is an example of such an attempt. We make very specific prediction of some rather spectacular experiment and challenge experimentalists to measure.
You know, they keep changing.
What keep changing? I don't understand. You're making a sociological remark, Chandra. Can we talk about physics?
It's become more like a religion. So
Wow.
Can I ask about the U1 case? Is it really that you've got a whole class of Hamiltonians which you've projected some part of the Hilbert space? Is that really the underlying philosophy behind
the starting point?
Gauge theory?
No. I think that's related. No, our starting point, microscopic Hamiltonian, is something like a TJ model. Or maybe with T prime. That's right. And the way you do that is to project, right. And that automatically gets you some gauge theory is one way of doing that. But the gauge theory would emerge. But beyond that, and there are many different ways of enforcing that constraint. You can do it with U1, with Z2, you can do it with SU2. So that's what Matthew was saying. The formulation, you can have different formulation which solves the same microscopic Hamiltonian. But when you go down, if you solve all these formulations correctly, the low-lying physics may be the same. And what emerge, even if you start with a U1 formulation, you can have a Z2 formulation, you can have a U1 gauge theory emerging at the end. Right? It's just a matter of convenience. Now, obviously, if you're looking for U1 gauge theory, it's better to start with a bigger group like SU2 or U1. If you start with Z2, it's very hard to generate U1 because you want to start breaking things. And so that's the philosophy. So Matthew has a very good point. We have to make a strong distinction of the formulation you write to try to solve the constraint and the emergent property.
Well, I would like to ask, you told that in the early days of REB, when people look to merit here, in other ways, when you got false, then there was an instability towards phase separation in many people's results. So what's your feeling? Is this kind of state, the underdog phase, is it unstable? Is there tendency to phase separation or not?
I think a lot of these early results are disputed. I mean, for large J over T, there's phase separation. But for small J over T, which is a physical limit, I think there's no strong evidence for phase separation. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Wait a minute. Yeah, so the next part has to do with whether spin liquid has been seen or not. And I believe that this is the work that Brett also mentioned. This is Kanoda and company, 03 preserved leather. And they were looking at this kappa 2 organic. And I think these show very, and this material is just on the insulating side on the mod insulator. And in fact, by applying pressure, they can drive this thing through the transition. And let me just summarize what he sees. I have some view graphs from Kanoda, which if you ask me later, I can show you to show you more detailed data. But the important thing is that there's no order. This is an insulator that has no magnetic order from USR or from USR. But the spin susceptibility is finite at zero temperature. Very strange, like a Fermi liquid, but it's an insulator. And 1/T1 has two components. 50% of it has a linear T component and 50% has T square component. So the linear T, of course, again behave like a Fermi liquid, right? So this thing is looking like the spin part is looking at a Fermi liquid, but it's a charge insulator. Now, Imada, the important thing about this thing is that this thing is residing on something that's basically a triangular lattice, because he can tune the hopping parameter so that the belief is that this should be modeled by a Hubbert model on a triangular lattice. Okay. Now, Imada has some numerical evidence he has some very complicated technique of solving the Hubbert model on a triangular lattice without a sign problem, which shows, he claims to show that there's a spin liquid phase right in the proximity of the mod insulator. So in other words, when you go from a metal to an insulator, the first thing you encounter is a spin liquid phase, and then you go into this famous 120 degrees local phase.
What material?
Hmm?
This is an experiment.
Yeah, this is an experiment.
What material?
This is kappa 2 ET.
One of those ladder?
No, it's an organic.
Organic, one dimensional?
No, it's 2D. I'll show you later. I'll show you more detail. And very recently, Motronich have done projected wave functions on TJ model plus ring exchange model And he claims that this spin liquid state is stable. Now, since this object is living in a Hubbert model very close to a the mod insulator, we cannot use TJ model. We have to go back to the Hubbert model. And so now we try to formulate this Hubbert model as a gauge theory. And our work is really a rather straightforward extension of some, I think, very nice paper by Florence and Georges, where they use a slave rotor formulation for the Hubbert model. Traditionally, people can do this fermion boson decoupling for the Hubbert model, but that's the work of Cotley and Ruckenstein. But that involves introducing four bosons for the Hubbert model, whereas in the TJ model, you need only one boson. It's very complicated. And so the good thing about this is that with a rotor, you just need one rotor. So it's a much more economical theory. And the idea is very simple. The rotor, you identify the angular momentum of the rotor as a charge, so that the Hubbert U term is just U times the rotor square operator. And you have a constraint which ties the angular momentum of the rotor to the number of fermions. And then the electron, this D is a physical electron, is written as a phase of the rotor and the fermion, which carries a spin. Right? So this is the Hamiltonian with the constraint. And this is exact so far. What they have done is to do a mean field decoupling of this thing, right? And then work out some mean field picture. It gives some, I think, rather nice results. And what we have done is to go to a path integral formulation and decouple this Hopping term. We can write this whole thing as a path integral. The trick is to decouple this. Turns out that there's some technical intricacy in decoupling this term, because it's not a, usually you do Hubbert stratonics to decouple a square term, and here you have a product of two different things. So there's some technicality, but let me skip all that. And in the end, our result is that the low energy excitation is just described by the fermion and the rotor model, both of which are coupled to the same gauge field. So for example, the fermions are hopping with some self-consistent amplitude, and this is the gauge field as a hop, and the rotor has the same gauge field and a spatial component. Okay, and so the thing is that in our formulation, the settle point of our path integral is exactly the mean field theory of Georges and Florence. No, this is a general. You can do it even away from half filling, but because the mu, this is not exact now. This is low energy physics. So what it's done is I go to the settle point and then expand around the settle point and throw away all the massless mode, all the massive mode. And the only massless mode is, of course, the gauge field. Yeah, so, but this will be energy scale small compared with T or U. So it's still quite high energy scale. Now, this is still a non-trivial problem. And within this, you can find, if you can solve this model, then you might be, you should be able to find various phases, Fermi liquid, and so on and so forth. Yeah, then the mu is not zero.
The charge is counted by the rotor.
Yeah.
So what do the charges do? What do the rotors do when they
make? Oh, it fluctuates. Yeah, the rotors are fluctuating.
How do you get the right density then?
No, the density is controlled by mu.
Yeah.
I refer you on mu. And the constraint, see, because the spatial part tie the fermion number to the rotor charge,
right.
By fixing the fermion number, you fix that. See, he's already taking my discussion time, so. Okay, yeah, so we apply this to the Hubbert model on the triangular lattice, just apply the scheme. And see, it's very natural that a spin liquid should emerge in this case, because you see, the triangular lattice does not have particle symmetry. So at half filling, the Fermi surface is basically a circle, okay? So there's no nesting. And so unlike the square lattice, The Néel state is very natural. It's very hard to get the Néel state out of this. Okay, and so within mean field theory, we find that this spin on Fermi surface is stable. And now the good thing about this formulation is that if you look at the gauge theory, in the insulator, the rotor part is gapped, so we can forget.
Why do you need it in the first place? Why can't you just do this, with fermionic spin-ons on the triangular lattice?
Because I want to be near the metallocentric point.
Anyway,
okay, well, all right. If you're a believer, I don't need to sell this to you. Right? Okay. Right. So, yeah. Yeah, so basically this theory would reduce to a fermionic U1 gauge theory. Okay, so this problem is actually much easier than the strange metal phase that I talked about. Remember, the problem there is a boson. Now the boson is out of the picture, so I can use all the things that I learned 10 years ago on this. And so now we can come up with very specific prediction for this Kanoda experiment. Firstly, specific heat should go like T to the 2/3. This is something that Motronich also mentioned. And more importantly, the thermal conductivity should go, kappa over T should go as T to the 4/3 power. And this is because you have these spin-ons that carry spins, and they can transport, they will carry heat, right? And this T to the 4/3 power is the same 4/3 as the conductivity of the, maybe this is resistive, 1-, I think. Right. I'm sorry, that's the same negative exponent. Right? Anyway, some T to the 4/3 power. Friedemann-Franz. That's right, this is from Friedemann-Franz. But this is complete violation of Friedemann-Franz, of course, because this is an insulator. So this is an insulator. Okay? Total violation of Friedemann-Franz. Okay, so if anyone sees anything like this, it will be absolutely spectacular. Okay. So this, just to give you a little bit of detail, so we worked out the mean field and we showed that there's the metal, I can skip this, it's not important. So we use the same idea to try to say something about the honeycomb lattice. Now, why is the honeycomb lattice interesting? Well, you see, if you think about quantum dimers, the energy per dimer is 3/4 J. And the antiferromagnet per bond, if you just have Ising spin, is 1/4 J. And now, in one dimension, you have one dimer per bond. And therefore, the dimer energy per bond always wins over this. And this is why you have RVB in one dimension. Now, in square lattice, you have one dimer over per four bonds. And the dimer energy is 3/16. And so the dimer loses. And that's why you have Nail state in two dimension. Now, honeycomb is exactly in between. So I claim the honeycomb is between 1 and 2 dimension in that it has 1/3 of one dimer per free bond. And the dimer energy turns out to be exactly the same as the trivial Nail energy. So now we have a nice competition going on here. Okay? Now again, if you do the mean field theory, it's well known that if you solve the tight binding model on a honeycomb lattice, you get direct nodes. This is graphite. Right? You get two direct nodes. And again, spin density wave is not required because unlike the square lattice, you don't have a large density state for nesting. So again, in this model, it's hard for me to get an antiferromagnetic state. Now, what I worry about is a competition with dimers versus this resonating dimers. And so the question is, can this state be stable against dimers? And that requires a calculation of the mean field theory. And it turns out that if you just do the straight Hubbert model on the honeycomb lattice, the metallic state goes down, but just before it vanishes, then the dimer happens. This is a breaking. This means that it actually goes into a dimer phase. Okay, however, it's extremely close. It's a first order transition with a very very small jump. So we had the idea of turning on this T double prime, which hops across the hexagon. By tuning this, we thought we can move this guy around and maybe expose a dimer state. And indeed, in mean field theory, it does. Turns out that with a negative sign of this T double prime, there is I expose a small region of with dimers with a nodal spin on, which is stable against dimerization. Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. TJ, of course, would have the. TJ would most likely have, you know, then you can solve the simple antiferromagnet. Yeah. So the whole idea is that if you're near this, I want to be near this metal insert transition where ring exchange and so on, you have a lot of charge fluctuation and ring exchange becomes important. And this is what's required to stabilize this, certainly in the triangular lattice case. And that's for sure, because we know that Heisenberg model does not have a spin liquid phase on a triangle. And probably here too. Much less is known about this.
What would be the origin of
T? Oh, this is just for theorists' enjoyment. And the reason
for experimentalist realization
is it will be very difficult. Yeah. But but there's a reason why I'm interested in this Heisenberg model and why I put the T-double prime here. And that is the honeycomb lattice. It turns out that you can do quantum Monte Carlo on this. And there's no fermion sign problem. And with this particular T double prime across across, that retains the particle symmetry. So this problem we can do. And I'm working with Philippe Montou. I expect in a few months we will know precisely the answer, whether it's, there is such a state or not. I mean, this is a problem that can be solved. Now, if I put the other hopping, then I'm in trouble. If I put next nearest neighbor hopping, this hopping is not tolerated in quantum Monte Carlo. So this is good for theoretical torque. Now, of course, this mean field theory is only an indication. It's useful only to tell me that, well, if I tune this parameter, I'm going to push things in one way or another. It may be possible that if I solve this exactly, even the honeycomb itself may already have this spin liquid state if you're lucky. We don't know. Right? So that's the other question I want to pose. There are many material scientists here. Are there any honeycomb ladders with spin a half? I think they will be interesting candidates for amusement. So just to summarize, I think this is a very exciting time for spin liquid people, because there's a lot more understanding, and looks like there are real experiments now emerging, and there are more than one candidates for this sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, you need to be near. Yeah, so you can squeeze. If you squeeze graphite, then that will be a challenge. Yeah.
Honeycombs can be easily assessed by CDS inspection.
Yeah. Uh huh.
My recollection is that there are no yield. So probably
for Hubbard model.
For Hubbard, yeah. Half field.
Uh huh. I see. I see. But with the pure Hubble model, there's no indication of anything funny. So what happens there? Is it Nail ordered, or is it? It's not even dimerized. Yeah. I mean, the weakness of this mean field is that I don't know how to estimate the Nail energy. So it could be that Nail wins after all. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Away from half-filling of the triangle and your approach,
you say you have a
solution?
No, I don't know. We haven't looked at. So far, we have focused just on the half-fill, yeah.
So I agree, the formula doesn't apply to the half-filling.
Yeah, but we haven't done it. Well, of course, once you dope, then you have a metallic state.
Well, that's what I thought.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, that's
Fermi-liquid.
It's Fermi-liquid, yeah. So that's for sure, and it's not interesting.
This is kind of a sort of general question. In the world of spin liquid, especially using fermions to describe spins, the Nail state is another universe that's out there. You can't really very well formulate it in this.
No, it's not true, because the Nail state will emerge by a process of chirosymmetry breaking, if you like. So if I start with the nodal Fermi liquid, and if I take gauge field into account, if the gauge field is in the confining state, then I would get Nail state. So it's a very natural consequence of this nodal.
Why do I never see the Nail state in any of the phase diagrams you discuss? Why doesn't it come naturally?
It does. Yeah, but you have to work harder. You have to solve this. If you put this nodal fermion plus gauge field on a computer and solve it, you'll get a Nail state.
Oh, no one's denying that the full-blown...
No, not even the full-blown.
Has a
yeah,
state.
Right. But I'm saying that within that formulation, you could get a Nail state, or you could not. It depends on the coupling constant, on the gauge field coupling constant.
It's harder to get confinement than it is to get Higgsing, which is, I mean, in the bosonic spin-on formulations, magnetism...
It's harder. You have to work harder in the fermionic formulation, but you can get it.
It's just that experimentally we know that magnetism tends to appear by a second order phase condition, and yet here it's very very far away from the world in which you're doing.
It's not very far away. I don't think it's very far away.
Well, it's at least a heavy computer calculation.
Right. Yeah. Well, what do you mean by far away?
Okay, anything else? Everybody's tired and hungry? or at least under you. Okay, well, nothing else. I thank all the speakers.